This is On the Other Hand. A podcast sponsored by Braver Angels in Arkansas that explores politics and other issues of importance to Arkansans through conversations with community leaders. Stay with us as we talk to another leader in Arkansas who works across differences to get things done and to bring us closer together.
Well, in the first part of our conversation, Glenn, with Wendell Griffin, we learned several fascinating things about his work and about how he looks at the inherent dignity of every person, regardless of their background. He talked a lot in that first episode about how his view of religion and evangelizing as mentoring. And I just love this whole two-part conversation.
Let me ask you a question that I think may help you elaborate on this or get at some other aspect of what we're talking about now. Now, you know, in Braver Angels, our organization is developed to reduce political polarization and to get people to respectfully engage with people on the other side politically. In doing that, we hope that it'll reduce stereotypes about the other side, basically humanize people a little more. Occasionally, we even find out that our people with on different sides of the political fence have some common ground, even if it's just common values, but different ideas how to do that. That gives us a basis for compromise, though, and it allows those relationships to be maintained across the political spectrum. And I think that's really critical for a healthy democratic system of government. So that's kind of where Braver Angels is coming from, if I can summarize it that way. But there are some people who object to what Braver Angels does, and their notion, which I understand where they're coming from, is that when we reach out to other people on the other side who are believing and advocating for things that we think are wrong and harmful, we're in essence giving, you know, comfort to the enemy. So any kindness to the other side is seen as weakness in advocating for our own position. Now, to me, I think this is one of those examples of what's called competing goods, where two legitimate and desirable values come into competition with each other and draw us in opposite directions. In this case, between a good of civic engagement versus a good of opposing bad things. So I'd like to, that's kind of my little elaborate introduction, but I'd like to hear your thoughts on this dilemma that I think we all face. How do you strike a balance between those two sometimes contradictory approaches? So like when you have difficulty with respectfully engaging with some people who are on the other side, what's your approach to speaking up for your beliefs in ways that still allow the possibility of engaging with that person who may be open to hearing you with the right approach? And where do you draw the line and why?
I'll draw an analogy and I'll take it from my childhood. We all went to childhood and we played games. We came with the notion of fair play. Every game has rules and every game has fouls. If the game becomes foul prone, it's no longer a game, it's a war. You can have an intense competition. You can compete very, very actively. Billie Jean King and Bobby Riggs, I know this is old stuff for people of a certain generation. Billie Jean King and Bobby Riggs had an intense competition. Bobby Riggs said that women could not beat men. Billie Jean King said, okay, yes, we can. And they had an intense competition, but they had a respectful competition. Magic Johnson and Larry Bird were fierce competitors in basketball. But Magic and Larry respect each other as competitors. Wilt Chamberlain and Bill Russell competed actively. I draw these examples to say that competition is inherent in human conduct. It can be done healthily, or it can be done in a toxic kind of way. I am not a fan of capitalism simply because capitalism does not value healthy collaboration between workers and wealthy. It values hierarchical relationships between workers and the wealthy. And the It's not competition. It's not collaboration. It is exploitation. Collaboration does not have to be exploited. Collaboration does not have to be combative. And collaboration does not have to be foul. I can disagree with April. She can disagree with me without us trying to dehumanize each other. We may disagree strongly and may never agree about an issue. However, I have to respect her right to believe, even if I believe in my heart that what she believes is not only wrong, but heinous. What I cannot afford, however, to do is allow her right to believe to operate to my destruction.
I'm curious about that because some people call, you know, talk about drawing a kind of a red line in the sand. It's like, if you go this far on your beliefs, then I can't even talk to you. So what I'm hearing you say is that even if I had heinous beliefs, you could still have a conversation with me in a discourse and a dialogue, as long as I'm willing to have a dialogue with you.
I sat side by side with Rabbi Barry Block of Temple of Benai Israel of Little Rock on Sunday afternoon for a conversation about Palestine and Israel. Rabbi Block is, by his own terms, a progressive Zionist. I believe that's a contradiction in terms, but that's what he said. I believe Zionism is a racist and supremacist ideology. We sat side by side for an hour and a half, and we disagreed almost everything. At the end of the conversation, we went our separate ways. We hadn't changed each other's mind, but neither of us felt the need to kill each other.
I heard about that conversation. I didn't get to attend it or watch it, but what kinds of communication skills were going on between you that allowed you to be able to talk to each other, not past each other, and not want to kill each other afterwards?
Well, I think that we have to realize, first of all, that violence never resolves anything. If you kill the person with whom you disagree, you haven't done anything to make yourself right. You've just become a killer. And you have, by martyring that person, by murdering that person, you have not proven the correctness of your view. That's simply an exercise in force. Coercion is not persuasion, and it is not respectful. Secondly, you have to learn to listen, practice listening skills. We had, at the beginning of the conversation, the parliamentarian of the gathering said, hey, people will not interrupt either people. The panelists will not interrupt each other. The audience will not interrupt the panelists. There will be no shouting out. Engage in active listening. And also recognize that you cannot play tit for tat. You know, Glenn said stuff I didn't agree with. I said stuff he didn't agree with. Barry said stuff I didn't agree with. And I said stuff he didn't believe it. But the fact of the matter was, I wasn't going to spend the whole hour and a half saying, this is why Barry is wrong.
So how do you maintain when you're in that type of conversation and you're listening to them, whoever it is, and I'm talking about, you know, our listeners thinking about this, maybe they're not in a conversation on that topic or, you know, something that's so more high profile like that, but they're hearing someone talk to them and they're really not agreeing and they want to persuade that person that they're wrong, but they realize that coercion or that kind of persuasion might not go over well. What would you say to them? What can they do?
You can't do anything. First of all, you can't persuade somebody else they're wrong. Persons have to decide they're wrong. That's the fiction. That's the fallacy that we are going to argue somebody into our position. No. We demonstrate by our way of living and treating other people with whom we disagree that we respect their capacity to change, even if they choose not to. Now, I have a value system that dislikes people who refuse to change, but I respect the fact they have the right to refuse to change. And I can talk until I stop breathing, but I am not going to talk them into changing their minds. They will change their minds when they decide that their position is no longer tenable. And some of that is about self-interest. A lot of people hold views based upon their self-interest. And when they realize that their perceived self-interest is either not threatened by the view that they oppose, or that the view they oppose is not helpful to their self-interest, no matter how well or how long they've held it, they decide, okay, wait a minute. This is like a shoe that no longer fits anymore. Why am I trying to wear it? It hurts.
I think about something you said earlier, too, about that only the dead don't change their minds. The sign of a living thing is the capacity to change. I wrote that down because, I mean, when we encounter people who have such differing views than us, if we really encounter and approach it with curiosity of what led them to that perspective, or how is it that they can, you know, what does that provide for them? Or is there anything at all there that, oh, I haven't thought of it like that? We might actually change as well.
Two things that we talk about in theology a lot. One is discernment. But another one that an Old Testament theologian named Walter Brueggemann has written about very well is imagination. Part of the reason why we have so much trouble changing is we are not willing to stretch our minds to imagine a different reality, imagine different possibilities. We cannot imagine that life can be different from what we have lived or what we fear it will become if we don't do what we've always done. And fear is a terrible, terrible prison in which to live. And it is not a place one can grow. Nobody grows a healthy life in a garden called fear.
How did you learn that? I'm assuming there's some personal experiences that you've had there.
Oh, yeah. I didn't learn to swim until I was an adult. I was an adult with children. I was a soldier, but I didn't know how to swim. Okay. My sons were in scouts. My sons had to go on scout trips. Canoeing. I did not want my sons to go on scout trips without me. And so I said, I'm going to learn to swim. My sons went to swim class. And so I sat on the edge of the pool and learned to swim. The swim coaches watched me as they were teaching the other children how to swim, flounder around with my old body. And I was beating the water. But I realized if you sit on the side of the pool all your life, you never learn to swim. The only way you can learn to swim is to get over your fear. And you can't get over your fear on the shallow end of the pool. You've got to get into the deep water where you must trust the water to buoy you, and you must trust your body to, and you must learn that you are an amphibian. You began in a fluid environment, and you were created to exist in harmony with water. You exist in a world that is more water than land. You can learn to do this, but you cannot learn to do this if you are paralyzed with fear. You cannot have a healthy life in the garden called fear. So the side of the pool deck is not the place to learn how to swim. It's a place to be safe. But no matter how much water gets, but how much water gets splashed on you on the side of the pool, you do not learn how to swim.
So do you have a story about how you've done that in a relationship?
Oh, yeah. I've been married 49 years. Okay. And I like to say to myself and other people, my wife and I have been married 49 years to several people. You know, you have to grow. You cannot carry the mistakes, the hurts, the wounds, the memories, and make that the prison for a healthy relationship. Otherwise, basically all you do is you collect bricks for your prison. And what do you have a prison out of which you never grow? Another word for it is TOMB. It's a tomb.
Oh.
We become literally the walking dead. And that's what happens when you don't engage other people. You become the walking dead, and they're the walking dead. And so you have this society of zombies literally walking around trying to eat each other.
Boy, that's powerful.
I appreciate it, what you've been saying, and I love some of these powerful metaphors, particularly the one about sitting on the side of the pool. That's great. I also really agree with you that we can't change anyone's mind. They have, that's a choice they have to make themselves. That actually is very consistent with what we teach in Braver Angels. We tell people we are not here to change anyone's mind. We try to get, we've got a thing going on this year called Civil Conversations, where we try to get people from different sides together to follow some kind of communication skills in talking about different issues. Not because we expect one side to convince the other that we're right and you're wrong kind of thing, but rather help people understand that this is not a stereotype sitting across from me. It is a human being. And I've found by my interactions, there are some things I agree with them on, or we have some common values. They're mostly decent people. And that's the kind of thing that you're talking about, I think. That's the kind of thing that may open people more to considering their own beliefs, but we don't expect that to happen. It's not about changing minds.
Glenn, I will add one other thing.
Okay.
There is one factor that makes that impossible.
What's that?
Violence.
Yeah. Yeah.
Violence, which is another word of saying any violation of the other person, makes it impossible to have civil discourse.
I agree.
Violence is a death to civil discourse. And what happens is we have, this is pause for effect, we have sacralized, industrialized, monetized, and glamorized violence. Four things. Sacralized, we made violence sacred. We have industrialized, we've made violence a commodity. We have weaponized it. And we have glamorized it. Our most popular sports is football is, by its definition, not like soccer. Football is gladiatorial. And it is a billion-dollar industry in the United States, where we know that it creates brain injuries, soft tissue injuries, and joint issues. Yet we send our children into it. Because we have glamorized it. We have industrialized it.
One point about violence, because I totally agree with you. Violence is something that stops any kind of healthy, positive development. I think the other thing that I'm experiencing these days in our society is that, forget physical violence, it's gotten to the point where verbal or emotional factors are experienced as violence against a person. And there are actually some psychological reasons for that, the way our brains have evolved. But it does strike me as that one of the problems we're having with polarization these days, that people are unwilling to talk with each other. And many times it's because they're afraid of what will happen if they talk to someone on the other side. So it takes a certain amount of courage. And that's one of the things we're running into in our ongoing series of civil conversations, is that you have to have people who are willing to take the chance to get off the side of the pool and get in the water in the deep side and have a conversation. Now, we try to make it, we try to assure people we follow these rules, these guidelines. We're there to make sure it's okay. But, you know, that's one of the things I see going on. So I appreciate the metaphor you mentioned on that.
And you can't bring your guns and knives.
No. We don't have anybody go through an inspection process, but you know, we only welcome people who are willing to talk with each other with civility. So, well, you had mentioned about the forum that you were on the other night where you had the conversations with a rabbi who has very different views. And I heard really good things about that. So don't want to spend much more time on that, but do you have any particular things you learned from that experience? Any strong points that you might want to share with us?
Well, I didn't learn anything about the people whom I disagree with. I learned something about myself, and I learned something about the audience. First of all, people want to see civil discourse, even when they disagree with the people engaged in the discussion. They want to be civil. They don't want to see a wreck. I know we have we've glamorized, we've sensationalized confrontations. But we need to understand that conversation is the way you build community, not confrontation. And that's the first thing I recognize. And secondly, I recognize that we have a society that doesn't really appreciate civil discourse. We don't value it. Otherwise, we would want to teach our children to appreciate how to think and listen and learn more than they have been exposed to. Her. But we actually have a government in our state and a movement across the nation that is trying to shut down education, shut down discernment, shut down imagination, trying to keep people on the side of the pool, shouting at each other across the pool, and believing that the more they shout, the better they will swim.
Very good. So let me kind of, as we start wrapping things up in the next several minutes, I want you to talk specifically about Arkansas and what you see for our future. Maybe where we are in terms of politics or other areas where you've been active, but also where the future is taking us. And I hope you'll include not only any concerns you may have, because there's basis for many, but also some hopes that, you know, something you see hopefulness about.
I'll start with the hope. I see hope in our young people who are beginning and becoming very, very outspoken against attempts to shut down knowledge and cross-cultural discourse. Young people no longer want to show up in churches where other folks are hateful. They are saying, hey, mama and daddy, I will bury you out of the church you grew up in, but I will not marry in that church. I will not be a member of that church. If I will haul your earthly remains in there because that's where you went, and I will leave that place, but I will not take my money and establish a memorial in your name in that church, because quite frankly, I have loved ones, I have friends, I have lovers, I have neighbors who that community treats in hateful ways, and I'm not doing that. Now, I grew up in a time where you would never say to your mama or your daddy, in any culture, white, black, whatever, no, I'm not going to do that. You grew up in it, and you did it because that's the way this family works. No, our young people, that's a sign of hope. They are not living in the prison, and they are not afraid to say so. They're also not afraid to say so to powerful people. Young people from Central High School confronted Governor Sarah Huckabee Sanders and said, "You do not represent what we believe our school means. Yes, you have a graduate, you graduated our school, but you don't represent that." That's powerful. I couldn't see Central High School students in 1958 saying that to Orville Farms. If they had, Arkansas would have been a very different place today. Another sign of hope. We have more cross-cultural discourse. We have people who are from different economic backgrounds and income groups and languages interacting with each other intentionally. Those are good signs of hope. We have problems, however, because those efforts are not empowered and they are not institutionalized. The institutional power, the commercial power, is in the side, on the side of violence and force and fear and self-interest and demonizing other people because they're wrong, as opposed to recognizing that they are human people with whom we simply disagree or hold different views. If we cannot move away, we will have to dismantle that destructive side. It does not stop on its own. No cancer stops on its own. The only time it stops is it when it kills the host. You have to cut the cancer out.
Do you have any specific recommendations for what our listeners can do that will help make a difference in their communities, in particular in the idea of bringing us closer together?
Read widely and read differently. If you are only reading the latest issue of your local paper, whether it's online or whatever, you have not read widely enough and you're not thinking differently enough. Question, question, question. Not only question what you read, but question what is not being said. Whose voices are not being heard? Whose perspectives are not valued? If there's a meeting, who's not in the room? We had a good session last Sunday, but at the end of the session, I realized something. There were no women on the panel. And so question. Thirdly, remember that you never get from good to better by glorifying good. You get from good to better by critiquing the elements you call good and finding the flaws. Because even in a good process, there are flaws that need to be corrected if it is to be improved. Finally, remember surprise. Prepare and allow yourself to live in the world of surprise. If all you want is sameness, you're not living in the world of surprise. You're simply living in your tomb, and you're simply changing the color scheme in your tomb.
Wow. That's very powerful. So many things. I wrote lots of notes here as you've been talking, things that I want to go back to and think about on my own. And I certainly want to pick up a copy of the two books that you mentioned that you've written and look forward to the new book that you're going to be having coming out later this year, Hateful Faithful, as well. Is there anything else, Wendell, any last words of advice, wisdom that you'd like our listeners to know about you or about anything at all?
April, Glenn, I first of all want to thank you for having me on. Glenn mentioned this, and I was surprised and flattered. But I would, to answer your question, I'll go back to Martin Luther King's last book. Where do we go from here? Implies that we have the choice of our destination. We have the power to make the journey. The question is not whether we will go, but why won't we go to community? Why will we stay and build chaos, seeing all the devastation and harm it's created? How do we become what Howard Thurman called the beloved community? Mm-hmm. That's our choice. Mm-hmm. And that is not only the choice we have as humans. That is the choice that's going to define the future of the planet. Mm-hmm. The future of birds, bees, monkeys, and trees will be determined by whether we build community or chaos. And our children's children will curse us if we choose chaos.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate your being here, Wendell.
Thank you for letting me come on.
Yeah, it's a lot to chew on here, I'll tell you that. I really appreciate it. I knew it would be good, and I'm really appreciating your being here and giving us some things to think about. Well, we hope you enjoyed this second part of today's conversation with Wendell Griffin.
And Glenn, really, as I think about both of these episodes, it reminds me of why I joined Braver Angels to begin with. I think about, I have found that there's so much chaos in our political system right now. And he really talks about community versus chaos and how, you know, there really can't be those two things coexisting. And I think about how we're trying to build, even in our small neck of the woods in Arkansas, this kind of view of having civil dialogue and conversations in Braver Angels. And I know that I'm learning to do that in my own relationships. So I'm excited for people to actually hear both parts of the conversation. So really encourage people, if they haven't heard the first part, to go back and listen to that.
Be sure to check out the first part of our two-part conversation with Wendell, as well as all the other podcast episodes of On the Other Hand. You can find those on the podcast page of the Braver Angels website at arkansas.braverangels.org or on many popular podcast sites.
And we'd love to have your program feedback or suggested speakers. So when you visit our website, in addition to links to all of our episodes, you can find a link to email us at otherhandar@gmail.com.
On the Other Hand is sponsored by Braver Angels in Arkansas. Music was composed by Randall Standridge of Jonesboro, Arkansas, and was performed by the University of Northern Colorado Symphonic Band. Dr. Richard Main, conductor.
From your host, April Chatham Carpenter,
and Glenn White,
let's each do our part to bring our community closer together.